texted me, was talking to me about, she's a casual viewer of the show, and she's like, that music at the beginning of the last, I was like, I know, right?
I mean, it was obviously completely unexpected. It was, you know, so exciting when literally after the finale, all of a sudden online, these things started popping up, and on Twitter, all these amazing and wonderful tweets were coming in, and I was... It was very excited. It was really humbling. It was so great.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're speaking to the man responsible for that tune that's been stuck in your head for the past five and a half, 6 years, Mr. Ramin Djawadi.
Welcome. Welcome to our humble show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for your music gracing our humble show for these past years. It's nice to talk to the man behind the strings.
Well, the strings, the percussion, the piano, everything, it seems. Is there any instrument you won't touch?
You know, it's a good question. Not really. I mean, every season we always joke and we go, okay, so what, you know, what instrument haven't we used yet? Like, I remember it was, when do the Thins, when they did introduce, we said, what about the tuba? So I figured out a way to play their theme on the tuba. And so there's always some new instrument that we come up with. And this year, obviously, the big new instrument was the piano, which was such a big surprise. But yeah, it seems to be ever expanding. That's what I love about the show. It's so fantasy based that there seems to be no limits to really what can be done in terms of instruments and styles, and you know, and I just love mixing it all together, and it's been great fun.
I want to say this light of the seven track from season six's finale has been in my head since I first heard it several Sundays ago. But actually, it's also partly due to because I've just actually had it on repeat on my computer all the time since
fantastic.
Then. Yeah, I'm probably responsible for about 100. To 500 of the 3.4 million views on YouTube of this Light of the Seven.
Is that where it's at now? Oh my God, that's incredible.
Yeah, just on YouTube, of course, Spotify, iTunes separate, obviously, but...
Yeah, what happened on Spotify viral where a piano track from a television series made number one?
Right. Yeah, when somebody told me that, I had to look it up. I couldn't believe it. Yeah, it's just incredible. And also, by the way, it's 10 minutes long. We're not talking about like a three-minute showpiece. It's 10 minutes long. How cool.
I'm just waiting for like the club dance remix version and the all the extra like remix versions to come out as well that people will do.
The metal version. I think we need a metal version, right?
Please. Need a metal version.
For the longest time, we used the rock and roll version of the opening theme song for Game of Thrones. And that was a special thing.
It was great. That was one of the first ones I heard when back in season one, when like a couple, it was literally like, I think I want to say 2 days after the episode aired when David and Dan sent me a link with that cover. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. It was really well done.
And I'm sure that was like very like flattering. It was really great to like see what fans' takes on the music are and see how involved people get as well. I think people are already clamoring for, you know, wanting to know if sheet music will be released for Light of the Seven and for all your work and how they can continue to incorporate. Like I spend hours on YouTube looking at some of these, you know, fan covers and stuff as well as the music itself. And it's like a really cool community that's built up around your work and about like the audio component of the show, which has always been, I think, like masterful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think that's where the internet, it can be so powerful, where people around the world can be creative and come up with their own cover versions and on different instruments yet again, and just record themselves and play it. And then it's just instant how quick it can just be on the internet and on YouTube and everybody can see it. It's wonderful.
Most of the feedback that we've gotten this season, I think something that's been a highlight for me is how many people have been talking about the score and talking about how that has enhanced certain scenes more so than almost ever before, which I think is really cool. And I think just continues to add depth to something that we already really love. And a lot of the questions, I don't know if we want to jump right out of the gate with this, but the piano featured in episode 10 and how that's such a change from what you've done in the past with the scoring and why that decision was made and how that's been different from anything else you've done with Game of Thrones.
Yeah, sure. I mean, what I love about Game of Thrones is obviously that, you know, every season there's a new surprise and, you know, we never know what's going to happen with the characters and who's going to get killed off and what's happening with the plot. And what I loved about this season was that you know, not only did we have lots of twists and surprises as with there, like with every season, but on top of that, we were able to actually throw a little surprise in with the score, which got me really excited because, yes, we used piano for the first time ever in the show, because even though that we have so many different instruments, the piano just has never been part of the language of the score. And so when the piano came up, it definitely, it took a little bit to settle. And I remember when we started the season, David and Dan, I hadn't even seen episode 10 yet. They were still working on it. And they said, look, I mean, we just want to tell you ahead of time, there's this great scene coming up. It's really long. There's hardly any dialogue. And, you know, we want it to be different. And then I also mentioned that Miguel Sapochnik, the director, I believe actually he might have been the first one to say, you know, what about piano? Like, let's just try something different. So it came up in the discussion before I even had written anything. And then I saw the scene and then I started writing it. And we definitely, you know, thought about it for a while. And we even thought like, well, this could also be harp or it could be on bells, you know, different instruments that we have used throughout the score and in the show. But we always came back to the piano. And finally we just said, look, it just has to be the piano. It's just different. Nothing sounds like it. And it's just this haunting, the decay and the attack of the piano. It's just so different. There's nothing like it. So I wrote this piece and then we just all said, yeah, piano it is. And it definitely took people by surprise, but I'm glad that it took people by positive surprise, that the reaction was so positive, because people was like, wait, what's this? But it really gets your attention. And again, there's hardly any dialogue. And so you can focus in on it. And it's the fact that the scene is so long, I had a chance to just really expand upon it. And then of course, an organ we have as well in there, which we had used organ before last season with Circe, but it was sort of in the background. It was never as dominant as it is here. So we bring the organ in. We have I'm using two choir boys, these voices in there. And then the actual orchestra, the strings, they don't even start playing until the very, very end of the piece. And then, of course, the cello, which has been so much used in the show as well. So it's like all these instruments come in one by one, and I could slowly build this piece to, you know, this big climax that, you know, you as you watch the scene, you slowly realize, wait, this is what's happening. Yeah. I can't believe it. So it was a feast for me. So I was very, very excited when I first, I mean, my jaw dropped when I saw the scene. I thought it was just so beautiful.
The Light of the Seven has been one of the largest takeaways of season 6. Mm-hmm. A track from Game of Thrones has been one of the largest takeaways from Absolutely. Their most successful season. That is so cool.
The layering of the piece as people are getting, as Cersei and as the High Sparrow are getting dressed, you know, as well, like they're putting on their layers and the music is building.
Yeah.
I think haunting is definitely the right word to describe it. It's almost as though there is a piano in their chamber with them, just sadly, you know, kind of moving towards, it really felt like fate growing. And I think it was all for the build and how it was shot. It's really just kind of impressive. The show continues to impress me on all fronts. And I think that's probably true for everyone.
And another thing that we also had discussed is that because also musically, it was a completely new theme, like that we had never heard before, that was also something we had discussed. Like, you know, this has to be a new piece of music. Like, we can't play the Lannister theme, we can't play the Sparrow theme. Like, let's just have it be sort of in neutral, so it doesn't even tip you in any direction, and you just slowly figure things out. And what I did do is I did plant the main title theme in there twice, though. I just thought I do want some kind of overall connection to the score, because, you know, with the piano, it was so new that I thought I definitely want to put the main title in there. So it plays in there twice and then kind of quickly goes away from it again. But it was just kind of fun to put that in.
I love that.
Part of the success and suspense of this show is the uncertain nature, something like the Red Wedding. I'm thinking of the scene that we're talking about, the build up to what happened. I think we all had ideas moving into the episode, but no one was quite sure. Mm-hmm. And you're basically the guy at the reins that's tasked with, you have to create that sort of neutral music piece that's telling us without telling us what's about to happen. That is so much pressure. And it must be really cool to see it come out so successfully.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where music can be so dramatically powerful, because you can either lead the audience by playing it a certain way that you want the audience to feel a certain direction, or you can also mislead them and playing against it, and then therefore mislead the audience. So that's where music, without any words, can have so much power. And that's been, especially in a show like this, has been really, really fun to do.
Nobody's misleading an audience on Game of Thrones, surely. It's all very straightforward. Jon Snow and his parentage and his life coming back to life. Never would be misdirected by music or otherwise.
Our listeners and the readers and watchers are curious of your process. Like, what does a day of work look like for you? It's got to be different working on a television series like Game of Thrones, that you've been able to develop themes and a relationship with these characters personally, but also professionally.
Yeah, it's been, since day one, has been really great on the show. And David and Dan have been so great to collaborate with, because obviously I heavily rely on their input and their guidance of where things are going. So the... as an example, I always like to use, for example, Daenerys's theme when I started writing the show and episode 1 and 2, and I said, yeah, we need a theme for Daenerys. So I wrote something and then we listened to it. And then I said, well, Ramin, but you have to be aware, because I also have to add that I have not read the books. So I'm just,
I don't know if we can have you on the show anymore.
Yeah. I apologize. Okay.
Bye, Ramin. Thank you for coming.
It's been really great to have you.
Yeah, I will read them one day, but I am, when I was aware of the books, but when I was brought onto the show, it was like I was focusing on writing the music, then like going back and actually saying, okay, let me read the books.
Sure.
So I just either read the script or look at the footage in front of me and again listen to David and Dan and say, like, you know, this is what we're doing, this is what we've planned. But so with Dani, they said, well, look, you know, at the end of the season, she's going to become very powerful, so we need to make sure that this theme can become very powerful. So it's very interesting how over the course of 10 episodes, you can plant something very early on and then just develop it in something bigger and bigger. And it's amazing that you can have, instead of like with a movie where you have only 2 hours, you can have 10 hours in one season. And then obviously in several seasons over, and you can push further and further and further. So with all of these characters, it's been really great to just develop these themes.
It sounds like you love the work.
Oh, it's been incredible. Yeah. I mean, so every season we get together, we watch all the episodes, and it's what's called a spotting session. So we sit down and we literally watch the show from beginning to end, and then just discuss the different scenes, where music should even start and stop, and then creatively what the music should do, dramatically what it should do, and again, you know, misleading the audience or leading the audience, and all these things we discuss together. And then I go and sit down and write it all. And then I meet with David and Dan again and play it to them. And then we tweak things. And so it's this ongoing process as we go through the season.
This is a question from Flayed Potatoes on Watchers on the Wall, who wrote in and asked if the process for writing was different for season 6, because there was so much secrecy surrounding a lot of things that we weren't going to get, that we usually get in the books, that we were now going to get in the show. And you kind of talk about misdirection a little bit. I don't know if there was any difference in that, knowing that the audience was going to be more in the dark in season 6 than normal, or if things were just mostly the same.
I think in that aspect, it's been mostly the same. I mean, the certain things we could just, like, for example, this season I had written a new a Jon Snow theme, which we just didn't use until episode 3. When he's alive and we see him again, and that's when the first time we use his new theme. So we were just very careful with not playing any new music or anything that could trigger anything of like, wait, what's this theme and who does it belong to and all this. So we just always waited until it actually was revealed visually as well. Mm-hmm. I guess the one big difference I want to say this season was that I felt we had probably more music than we've ever had before, because I feel there were just a lot of big scenes and epic scenes very early on already. Many times in the other seasons, it's been the buildup had been always towards like Hardhome or the Wildlings attack. And then we had these big scenes towards episode 9 and 10. But I felt like this season, we had it very early on already. I mean, there was the burning hut with Daenerys, and the Hodor scene. That was, again, musically speaking, that was a 10-minute or 12-minute piece of music, and that was episode 5.
Mm-hmm. And it was basically Hardhome part 2, right in the middle of that.
Exactly.
When I think about when Sansa and Theon are running through the woods, like in the very beginning of the whole season.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was another moment that stood out for me musically. So
right. Yeah. So it was great that we just had a lot of these big moments already very early on. And I think that resulted also in that we had unusually more music in earlier episodes already than normal.
I remember sitting in an IMAX screening of Watchers on the Wall, and I think the track is Let's Kill Some Crows clicks in, and the camera moves overhead and sort of moves over the wall and down to the action that's in front. And you've got a mixture of all these new instruments that you haven't yet heard in Game of Thrones, but they're playing familiar themes and the scales are similar and it's all playing within the same structure. And I can't really describe what exactly hit me in that moment, but I knew that the show was sort of halfway through and we had so much more left, but just this ridiculous confidence in what was yet to come. And I feel like musically I don't want to say one-upped yourself, but you've continued to increase the epicness, the scale of which the show operates on and which the story does.
That has definitely been, you could see it this season just because of the, you know, I'm guided by the story purely. I'm the one that's just allowed to paint more of what's in front of me. So the story and then obviously also the visuals, I'm just supporting the drama of that. So this season, it was proof of that is again, that how much the story has expanded and like the Battle of the Bastards, that's some of the most epic battle that I've ever seen. Yeah. So the musically, I have to make sure
violent,
this is
just pure violence.
Oh, it's just incredible. And I love the ups and downs between, the violence and then the emotion and the, you know, the sacrifice and the heroism. And I mean, it was all in there and it just kind of beautifully interweaved into, you know, from one to another. So I just had to, I just tried my best to with music to just underline that. And, but it's just, there's such a scope to the story now. And, So with the score, I've been able to just really open it up.
And in that same episode, you were able to do another descending when the dragon decided to roar out its fire.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the signature.
It's a good touch.
When that word get Dracarys gonna get said, then it has to musically, that has to. That's a must have now, right?
When I was watching that episode for the first time, I knew what was coming because of that moment. I was like, okay, here we go.
Well, that was a case of the music being generous, including us in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, but it's really special, truly, to notice, like to be watching an episode and you start hearing like the Reigns of Castamere playing and you're like, you no longer feel certain or confident in anything in life. And you're like, what's going on? Wait a minute. You know, and just kind of heightens the, like we've known to expect it. Like we know the cues, we know the reaction, you know, like it helps draw us in even further and make us feel even more vulnerable, I think, when we can recognize it. So it's really amazing. The music is obviously very great. It's so hard to like talk about like, oh man, this is why we find it amazing, why it produces this emotion in us, but it absolutely 100% does.
Yeah. It's a huge piece of it.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. It's wonderful to hear. Yeah. So great. No, I'm so happy to be part of the show. I mean, it's, I love that because there's so many different characters. There's so many different storylines. There's so many different locations. Musically, it is, you can be really creative.
How do you get involved with doing Thrones, like from the start?
They called me up. I think they were interested in working with me, and they called me up and showed me the first two episodes, which I, you know, obviously my jaw dropped, and I thought, wow, this is amazing.
Something new, something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it just looked incredible, and you could just see where this was all going. And then, I met with David, Dan, and Carolyn, and we sat in a room together, and we just started brainstorming of how to even tackle this massive story with 1,000 characters and 1,000 plots, and, you know, how can we even sort of make sense out of all of this, and we just hit it off. We just were on the same page immediately, and had great ideas, and like I said earlier, the guys are just, they're really great in guiding me and helping me with ideas, and just, they have a wonderful vision, an overall vision of what they want to do with the show, and that obviously has a huge impact on what I write and how I write it. And so it's been an amazing collaboration. I just every time I'm in the room with them, it's just super creative. It's amazing.
Have you ever brought an idea or an instrument or anything like that to the table and had it been completely shot down?
Probably. I mean, let me think if I can think of one.
Harmonica, right?
No, I don't think I've tried harmonica. Or something, I don't know.
You know, what's great too is when you have a great relationship and when you, you know, when you try to create something new and something different, I think it's also important to make mistakes. So what's nice is, you know, that especially now in season 6, when we've worked together now for years, and it's to not be afraid of making a mistake. So sometimes, yes, absolutely, I'll come up with something and then I either get the thumbs up and they go, this is great. Or sometimes they go, well, we're not so sure about this, you know, maybe for, you know, season 8 or something else, or maybe not for this show. You know, there's definitely, we've had sometimes things where I just pushed it too far and then we just kind of, then we rework it or something, but that's again, that's what makes it fun too. Like it's okay to make mistakes. Mm.
Mm-hmm. What was behind the decision for including the ticking sounds when the White Walkers come around?
Well, yeah, that idea was kind of the, I mean, what it actually is, it's called collenio. It's when the orchestra turns their bows around and hits the strings with the back of the bow. So it's the wooden part that they click. Wow. So it's kind of the idea is it's like skeletons clicking.
Right.
And I also, because of the whole ice thing, so I also tried to come up, because obviously, you know, they're so powerful and it's horror and this, but I also tried to come up with sounds that are not always low and bassy, and but something that's a bit more just that cuts through a bit also with the wind and everything. And so I thought this clicking skeleton sound could be really cool. But the way it's played, that it's just this constant, it's kind of the, you know, like there's just a force coming that you can just, it's
very
slowly,
suspenseful.
Yeah, it creeps up and it creeps up and you just hear this ding, 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 and you know, oh, here it comes. So that was, yeah, that was the thought behind that.
That's very cool.
There's a question here from Ferenian, from Watchers on the Wall Post, and this is kind of interesting. I mentioned the Reigns of Castamere before. We're all very familiar. Also, the other songs, you know, songs that have been mentioned at least in the books, in the source material, Bear and the Maiden Fair, The Dornishman's Wife. The question is, did you ever receive any direction as far as how those musical pieces should go? And like, to what extent did George R. R. Martin offer any insight? Was it mostly, you know, was it David and Dan? How did that sort of work with those particular numbers?
No, it was all David and Dan. I mean, Reigns of Castamere, I actually wrote that after season one, because usually I don't come back to the show once, you know, they finish shooting. And then when they go into post-production, that's when I come back in and start writing. Reigns of Castamere, they actually called me up while they were shooting. And they said, hey, Ramin, we have this theme that will become a, you know, will play a big role down the road, and we want you to think about it now.
Nudge.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, so obviously, yeah, they told me about the whole Red Wedding and everything. So he said, eventually, this is where it has to end up. So it needs to be a beautiful melody, but also a haunting melody. And then this is what we're going to do with it and everything. So I wrote it just based on the lyrics. That, you know, I didn't have any visuals or anything. So we just wrote the piece and I played it to them. And then what was fun is I'm pretty sure the first time you hear it is actually in season two, when Tyrion walks into a room and he's whistling the melody. So yeah, that was kind of the first mm-hmm. time.
That's when he goes to the small council and he's whistling.
Yes,
yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So he whistles the tune. So yeah, so it was based on the conversation like that, and that's how I wrote it. And then we set it up like this. So by the time you get to the Red Wedding, you go, you recognize the Lannister theme. And same with the other songs too. It's just, they would say like the Bear and the Maiden Fair, they just said, you know, this is more of like a common party bar song, you know, so this needs to be more of like, you know, that this kind of feel. So they kind of talked me through of what they were expecting to make out of these pieces. It was interesting. It's, you know, it's a different approach to write something to existing yeah. lyrics. So the rhythm is sort of, I had to figure out the rhythm and make it work. And yeah, it was
sort of fit in the same world that you've created already with the rest of the music as well.
Exactly, that too. Exactly correct. Yeah.
Sort of spiraling off of that, did you ever receive feedback from George? Have you met George R. Martin?
I've met him several times. Yeah, I think he's very fond of the score, and I've met him at events here and there, and when we've chatted a little bit here and there. I think he's unbelievable, and you know, he's the one that created this world.
Right.
We can all be thankful for that. You know. I still can't believe how he came up with this complex and unbelievable story. I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. you know, as you watch on, it's like it all kind of comes together and it all makes sense. So there's like this grand
yes.
plan for everything. And that's what's so genius.
Talking about the characters a little bit, is there a specific character or family house theme that you particularly enjoy writing with or working with more so than others?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I try to be kind of neutral and I want to make sure that I like it all and that I all treat them kind of equally.
Love all your children the same.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So the beauty is that there's usually a pretty good balance of you know, we are with Daenerys and then we're with the Starks and then we're with the Lannisters. I mean, sure, you know, thinking about, you know, Daenerys has had a lot of these big epic scenes because, you know, she has the dragons, she has the Unsullied, like her power just has been growing and growing and the dragons are growing. And so therefore she's had quite a few big epic scenes, but I try to keep it equal as much as I can.
Isn't it nice how well her music and the Greyjoy theme blends together in The Winds of Winter?
Yeah, that took me a while to figure out, because I knew I wanted to, because, you know, every year we have in the finale, I have to kind of figure out, okay, how can I reinvent this finale? What can I do different? What needs to be something new in this? And then I have this idea about, well, we have these characters together. Let's figure out how to merge these themes. And this year, yeah, it's been a bit of a challenge, but it's great how it worked out. We have the Greyjoy theme, we have Daenerys' theme, we have the dragon theme, we have the Unsullied theme. They're all kind of interplay in this Winds of Winter at the end, and the main title theme as well. It's the,
yeah.
Normally, it's not that I want to get too technical, but normally it plays in 6-8 or in 3-4 and 3 feel, and this time I put it in 4-4. So that's also something we hadn't done before. So yeah, again, just always having fun with the last piece.
I remember the soundtrack released a few days before the last episode of the finale, and I was going sort of methodically through each track and trying to guess, okay, this could be in episode 10. I've heard this. This may be in episode 10. What's happening here? And I remember listening to, I think the track is called The Tower, and I think it was like something like 3/4 of the way through the track, Goodbye Brother clicked in. And I think in that moment, I realized that my theory about Jon Snow and everyone's theory about Jon Snow was successful.
Maybe we shouldn't release the soundtrack.
I know.
Spoilers.
It's either that or it was promising, the music in a way was promising an equally cool reveal, right? Like, we're going to be happy about this no matter what it is.
It's just interesting that you can do that at all, that these themes over time, and that's all for muscle memory, are so wired in that the music, you know, is such a large character in the series. It's really awesome.
No, I mean, you're right. I mean, this is where the music can be incredibly leading or misleading, because I also tend to, if you look through the history of the soundtracks too, I sometimes tend to put tracks on there that are actually not in the show. I like doing that too. Like, for example, the track Needle, which is Arya's theme, only part of that is in the show. Some of it I just wrote completely separate, just because I like to expand the piece for the soundtrack. So some of it you hear in the end credits, I believe in episode 8, but the track as it is on the soundtrack is nowhere to be heard. So again, this can also be misleading if somebody listens to this before the season ends, and then the whole theory started, like, what could this piece be? But it's simply it's just a piece of music that I just liked and wanted to put on the soundtrack.
Yeah,
I like the mystery.
Cool. I love that.
The first thing that comes to mind more recently outside of Game of Thrones that I greatly enjoyed that you did some excellent work on was Duncan Jones's Warcraft.
Mm.
There's a huge selection of pre-existing music, and there's millions and millions of fans in that universe as well. And it was interesting to see sort of the evolution that you've taken certain characters from the Horde and from the Alliance.
I mean, it definitely was a challenge, because yes, there was all that pre-existing music, which also I admire greatly. I think it's incredible music, and it's been part of the history of the game and everything. But when they brought me in to do the movie, I just thought, well, let's put my own spin on it, and because I guess that's why I got the call, and also because it was a film, so it was definitely a departure from the game, and I sort of tried to stay within the language of the existing score, but yeah, yet again, just kind of make it my own at the same time.
What was the moment where you decided I want to be a composer for films? Because music is a discipline that can go in many directions, but you've targeted in and done a fantastic job with so many properties, whether they've been television shows or films, and you've worked side by side with some incredible creators and directors and done a fantastic job to bring already fantastic works into an even grander scale.
I mean, it was very early on. I want to say maybe I was 12 or 13, something like early on. I've always done music. I started learning actually the organ, funny enough, with Light of the Seven. Like, the organ was actually the first instrument that I learned when I was 4. I started learning on the organ, not the piano. So I played that for a while. And as a teenager, I realized that the music that I was listening to and that I was, like, just when I was writing, and I'd never really even thought about that, like, oh, I'm composing music. I would make up melodies and things. But I realized that my tendency was towards instrumental music. and also the music that just supports movies. And you know, obviously Star Wars is a big one, like for everybody. But actually, I think the one movie that triggered it for me where I realized, wow, this is what I want to do for a living, was actually The Magnificent Seven, Elmer Bernstein's score.
That's so cool.
That just completely did it for me. And then I thought, this is what I want to do. And so, yeah, from very early on, I just set out and really kind of focused on, you know, what is it that is the dramatic music that supports a visual, and that has always amazed me of what's possible. I'm very lucky to be living my dream and just be doing what I love.
I think I read in a Reddit Ask Me Anything that you study beneath Hans Zimmer and Klaus Badelt.
That's correct. When I was born and raised in Germany, and then I went to college in Boston at Berklee College of Music. And then by sheer luck, a connection was made with Hans Zimmer's studio, and I moved to Los Angeles and then started working as an assistant for Klaus Badelt, and just kind of learned the craft, but also the technology, because what was completely overwhelming. And I always like to tell the story when I first arrived in LA and I walked into the studio, if they had set me down and said, "All right, Ramin, here you go, just, you know, write us a scene," I would have just completely failed, because there's so many buttons and faders and things that I had no idea what to do, because I just, they literally had every piece of equipment on the planet. So I just didn't know how any of that worked. I didn't even know where the volume button was.
You're like, I just feel the music. Now I have to make it. Okay. Yeah. Got it.
Because technology is a big part of it. And so it was an incredible learning experience to see how Klaus and how Hans, you know, just the approach to even writing music for a film. And so they've been incredible mentors to me. And yeah, so that's how I then got my start.
They've done some seriously incredible work. I think that Pirates of the Caribbean, the He's a Pirate track from Klaus Badelt, will go down as one of the most remembered themes.
Sure.
But I feel like you've carved yourself a path that can be compared. I feel like Ramin Djawadi is building his own legacy right now. And it's been going on for some time now. But I'm telling you, that Game of Thrones theme song, that affects a lot of people. That's in a lot of people's heads. That's
incredible.
It gets a lot of people hype.
It does. They hear the end credits from across their house and they're like, oh, I better run to the, oh, is it Game of Thrones? Is on? Oh.
You know, it's funny you say that. That was always what I set out to do. I always said the main title is what has to draw you into run into the living room, and you're in the kitchen and you're pouring your drink or you're getting your popcorn, and then you hear the music and you go, oh, wait, it's starting. And then I want you to run into the room and sit down and watch the show. So great. If that's what that does to people, then I achieved my job. I'm happy. That's great.
I think it does.
Talking about that, are you aware that somebody has covered your theme for Game of Thrones by just the word and the name Peter Dinklage? Have you listened to that? Do you know, was that intentional?
That's
a pressing question. I think we need an answer.
I feel like, yeah, was that by design? Did you do that perfectly so that it fits his name?
You know, I should just lie now and say, of course, that's what I had planned. But I have to be honest, no, it was completely unintentional. But I love that somebody figured that out. It's pretty clever.
We played that on the show something like, I don't know, 2.5 years ago, and people to this day are still writing to us about the moment that we played that on our show. It is Peter Dinklage has clicked that much in people's heads from that theme song.
So funny.
That's great.
I have a quote here from a friend of mine, Dan Granada. He said, please tell Ramin that his stuff is incredible for me. He really liked Pacific Rim as well as Thrones. He says, I look for his name in credits all the damn time, and I root and whoop and cheer for him like we are childhood friends.
I think it's
really just an example of how your music has affected us as both like book readers too, and how these properties, these worlds that you're able to flesh out and really illustrate affect us on like a personal level and affect our emotions surely.
Yeah,
I love that. That's really great. I'm very happy to hear that.
I'm thinking of composers that have done what you've done, and I think specifically of John Williams, who had the responsibility to make Harry Potter musical, to give it a theme like you gave Game of Thrones a theme. And that's a very cool thing, because A Song of Ice and Fire very much so is a phenomenon, and there's books left to be published, and people will be lining up at midnight, and these next two seasons will be highly celebrated and more people will probably watch them. Unlike John Williams, you've taken Game of Thrones basically 10 hours a season, and you'll be taking it all the way to the very end, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I'm very excited to see where these next two seasons are taking us. Yeah, it's I honestly have no idea where it's going, but I can't wait to find out. And the challenges that or the excitement, I guess, that comes with it of, you know, whatever music we'll be creating for it.
I imagine it won't be quieter music.
Exactly.
Yeah. Probably, right. Yeah, probably not.
There's no returning now. There's no turning back anymore. Yeah, this is ever expanding.
And we got a question from Stark on Watchers who said, who would you like to sit on the Iron Throne in the end? Do you have any predictions about that?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I'm not sure. Again, it's like earlier with, like, you know, treating all the characters the same or equal with the themes. I'm not sure if I can take any preference or take any side.
You can say Sam. That's okay.
No, I don't. I really think about it neutrally. So I wouldn't even be able to make any predictions because I'm sure even if I made a prediction, I'm probably completely wrong because we know what George is so good at is whatever you think is going to happen is exactly not going to happen. So
we know because we're wrong all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 So.
I think it'll either be Gendry or Hot Pie.
I have a theory that we, and I may be wrong about this, but I have a theory that in a future soundtrack, we will have a track called A Song of Ice and Fire.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
That seems inspired. It also seems a bit on the nose. Like, here is the song of Ice and Fire. Right. You almost need to have, like,
I like
lyrics
the title.
To it.
It's a good title, though, for sure.
It's a good title. Yeah. Pretty strong mm-hmm. title.
I mean, you know, speaking of titles, we all, you know, obviously the title's always, because the soundtrack coming out before, we can never, you know, we have to watch out with what the titles are because... You know, people can figure that out pretty quickly, obviously.
Yeah.
People like
sorry
Zach trying to get their theories confirmed by the soundtrack.
I can't be the only one who did that.
No, I think it's a common practice. I remember because I think it's like movie 8 of Harry Potter, like Alzon Desplat's film, and like one of the tracks is just called like Dobby's Death. We're like, really?
Oh, wow.
Really? Because you know that people like on Amazon, because like it used to be a practice, like go on Amazon as soon as the soundtrack is given like a page and then look at what the track listing right. is. And you tell, you infer plot points. It's common. So I completely understand not being able to say it in the title.
I'm actually the opposite too. I don't even want to get spoiled. I like to actually see it as it happens. I don't even go on the internet and try to find out what's going to happen in this plot. I want to be surprised. I actually like it.
Well, you do us a great service because we get to watch Game of Thrones for the first time after you've created music for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to watch it without music for the first time.
Yeah, and also, you know, the effects are not finished and everything. So when I see it, it's definitely still, it's not as polished, you know, as it is when it's on the air.
Oh, I wanted to ask about that. To what extent is the like editing locked in? Like, is it still like the same time duration that you're working with, or like how does that sort of work?
We do a little bit of both. Sometimes I see something very early on when it's still long or you know just not completely finished. But most of the time, I get the episodes in front of me when it's already pretty much in the ballpark of what the final is going to be. And then again, we do the spotting session, we watch it, and then I write it, and then we go from there. And if there's any additional tweaks, sometimes when the special effects get finalized, they extend the shot or shorten it. You know, those things, they sometimes remain open until the very end, but it's pretty much all intact when I see it.
How different is the process creating? I know that you watched the show blocked in episodes beforehand, but how different is the process creating specifically for this television show or other television shows versus creating music for a film?
I mean, in a way, it's kind of the same. I mean, I really treat all my projects the same in a sense that I try to create the language for whatever project I'm on, meaning, you know, being that the themes, being the sound, certain instruments, like I tried to figure that out in the beginning, and then you kind of expand and develop the themes and you start writing. So I treat them all the same. Obviously, the big difference with Game of Thrones is that there's 10 episodes instead of two hours or anything. So it's a lot longer. But what's interesting too is that I do have more time to write than on a, you know, in quotation, a regular TV show that's week to week to week, because it's not, you know, like a regular TV show many times has like 22 episodes or something, but because we only have 10, it is the schedule is more spread out and I do get a little bit more time. And so it's kind of in between a regular TV show and a movie. Game of Thrones, I would say.
And the video game can't be that much different, right? I know that you worked on Medal of Honor.
Same thing. I figure out my language, and usually a video game can be very stretched out because by the time a composer gets brought on, that can be very early on, and they might only have one or two levels sort of ready. And as they're kind of programming away and developing a game, you are kind of feeding them with music. So a video game can be done over like the course of a year or a year and a half, and it's very spread out.
That seems really cool. I would love to see a video game be made, like to be in a room where they're programming and stuff.
Yeah, I agree. I went to the EA office and I've seen kind of the how they do the testing and all that. It's very, very cool. It's a great process. It's very long. I mean, there's so many hours that they all put into it. It's unbelievable, especially also towards the end when you're just getting to a deadline. And I mean, that's like with any other project too, but it's just implementing all the sound effects and all of this. It's the detail work is incredible.
And you're basically doing the same thing. You're writing alongside the sound effects and the action when it comes to a scene like Hard Home, or when it comes to a scene like the Battle on the Wall, where you have a responsibility of all these musical instruments sort of clashing while their swords and shields are clashing at the same time.
Yeah, that's a good point too, is because what's interesting is with these hard schedules, because everything is always, you know, it's just always, we always, you know, you always wish you had more time and you wish you had more time. But so most of the time we're working in parallel. So while I'm writing the music, the sound department is creating the sound. So they don't hear what I'm doing and vice versa. So, but what we have been trying to do, and many times we have been able to do, is that I would send over some of my demos to them so they can kind of see where I'm heading, like with Hard Home, with my clicking noises and things like that, so that we kind of don't cancel each other out with sound. And that's, I think this is something that the show, and then also the mixers do an incredible job of. There's moments when the music is in the foreground, and then there's moments when the sound is in the foreground or music is completely out. The balance, I think, is just, it's so important, and they do an incredible job with that of how that all gets implemented. It's a very tricky show to do, and I think it's just they do a really, really great job.
Have you been working with the same crew? Because your demos have got to be something like, are you laying down on a guitar or piano, and you're giving them probably a basic version of what's to come, and then they're writing all of their stuff around that?
No, it's a bit more fleshed out. My demos are pretty accurate because, like I said earlier, everything is based on the computer, so I use samples and things like that. So it's pretty fleshed out, and percussion is in there, and I record. A lot of the instruments that I use are these, some of them are experimental instruments that I've kind of found around the world traveling. And so a lot of them I play myself. And so I can already record them in. And then and later on, we do the recording session with the orchestra and swap out the sample strings and things like that. But the demos are pretty fleshed out. So it's good to work too.
You're talking about these deadlines and kind of working under different time frames with different projects. And this may be a cliche question, but just curious about where you draw your inspiration from, or where you continue to kind of keep that creative juice flowing, I guess you can say, and talk a little bit about how you continue to find inspiration as you're working against these types of deadlines.
Yeah, no, it's actually a great question, because I guess the deadline sometimes actually helps with the inspiration in the creative process, because you just have to get it done. And because I'm sure any artist will confirm this, is, you know, if you say, oh, you have 6 months to do this, you know, it's the typical artist is the procrastination process, right? Where you go, okay, yeah, you know, I did a little bit today. I'm not quite sure if this is, you know, maybe I can do better. And then you come back tomorrow and you change it and this and that. But if you have this strict deadline, you said, I have to have these amount of minutes written by then, you just you just sit at your desk and you will not get up until it's done. And, you know, it can be pretty brutal sometimes, but it's just, that's just part of the game. And obviously the other parts of inspiration, again, I come back to with Game of Thrones, you know, David and Dan, they have been, just by conversation and just their guidance is a really huge inspiration for me. And then for me personally, it's also visuals. Again, that's why I decided to do film music, because we're supporting visuals and just seeing visuals, like with Game of Thrones, the beautiful, the north, the ice world, and Daenerys's world, you know, the desert, all these different colors are very influential for me of what I write and how I write. And that's always been a big part for me.
David and Dan have shared that a good selection of the filming this year will be done toward the winter.
Right.
You'll have a little bit of stuff to play around with there. That's going to be so much fun.
I'm sure. Yeah, I know. I can't wait.
I think that we could talk to you for probably another 3 hours. So maybe next year, we'll see. Well, we need to get you back for part two. This has been a good talk.
For sure. My pleasure. Thanks for having me, and thanks for reaching out.
Thank you so much, sir.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
To everybody listening to the podcast right now, the song that you're hearing, well, you know, this guy made it, so.